Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 48 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Some of you are sitting there going, whoa, 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 whoa. Last week was a double with POS and Dessa, and that was numbers 45 and numbers 46. Those of you that are thinking of that, I will have missed the secret podcast that dropped on Friday, that little extra bonus. We gave you three podcasts for free yesterday. So yeah, you're welcome for starters. Pay more attention in future. And, you know, if you're grateful for all these free episodes you get, you could head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and buy stuff. Obviously, we've got the Team 3W t-shirts that keeps selling out and are going crazy. So thank you all for supporting that. But we've got a lot of other stuff. And one of the other things there is the new record by B. Dolan. And I need to talk a little bit. This is going to be a kind of long intro because there's a few things I want to talk to you about. It's a great episode. By the way, we've got JT from Banquet Records. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But I want to talk about, I want to initially just thank you all for your support of the B. Dolan record. It launched on Friday and the reaction has been absolutely overwhelming. And so much of it has been down to you guys spreading the word, supporting. I mean, we've had a delay on the vinyl and you've been insanely understanding and supportive of that. So everything, yeah, it means the world. Thank you for continuing to support. And thank you for realizing that this is one of the best rap records you're ever going to hear, or hip-hop or spoken word or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, if you've not checked it out yet, head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and check it out. This week's episode is with JT from Banquet Records. I loved having him on. I was inspired to do this one after how well the episode with Paul Vickery went down, Paul Vickery was at the Prince Charles Cinema, and that is, I think, of the last 3-4 months, it's either third or fourth most downloaded, and we've had some huge names, so it's beautiful. I explained at the beginning of that episode, the point of this podcast is that, and again, it was inspired in many ways by watching things like Jonathan Ross, who hopefully is going to be a future guest on the podcast. He said on Twitter he'd like to come on recently, so that'd be great. Now, I'm a big fan of him, but the thing that occurred to me was on his show, he gets millions and millions of viewers and he has four huge like Hollywood stars. And the fact is, three of those huge stars could get those millions of viewers and you could fill that extra space with someone who's just interested and has something to say. And that's the point of the Distraction Pieces podcast is, yeah, we have Simon Pegg and Billy Bragg and Russell Brand and, you know, all these big people. And next week we've got Neil Maskell, who's absolutely amazing. But yeah, we have all these big names, but we also have people who are just genuinely interesting. And the beauty of the fan base that we've already built up is you guys seem to be okay with that. Like, you don't go, oh, we're not going to listen this week because I've not heard of that person. So that's hugely appreciated. So we'll get onto the podcast shortly. One of the other podcasts I've mentioned before that has influenced the idea of that, of important people, intelligent people, unusual people, interesting people, and crazy famous people, is the Joe Rogan Experience. And the next thing I want to talk about is at risk of just turning this podcast into the Joe Rogan Experience, because he goes on a lot about flotation tanks. And I decided to try one out recently. I've had some stressful times recently. Let's not go into that. That's not important. But I decided to try a flotation tank, which is a sense deprivation tank. And I found this place called Floatworks in London, and they were nice enough to invite me down. And I fucking loved it. Joe Rogan often talks about how he's got one in his basement and he'll spend 2 to 3 hours in there for writing, for relaxation, for clarity of thought, everything. And I booked my session and they're generally an hour long. And I thought, man, that's a long time. I'll explain what it is. You get in this pod, essentially, and this pod is full of water that's got loads and loads of Epsom salts in so that you float naturally. And when you're in the pod, you have an option. Obviously, you can leave it open. You can leave it open, but in general, you close it down. And then there's an option. There's some nice lights in there and some nice music. Or you can turn all that off. And kind of the point of them is to turn it all off, I believe, or from what I've heard. A lot of people need to ease into that. So that I have the pod open slightly for a bit, or some music on, or some lights on. But I decided to go straight in. And so you float in there, and the point is the floating gives you kind of a zero gravity feel. So it kind of removes that sense of feeling or being grounded or touching anything. So it's different from just laying in a bed, because you've lost all of your weight, essentially. Obviously, the lights are off, so you're in pitch black because it's a closed, sealed pod. You have little earplugs in to make sure no more sound gets in. So the idea is complete sensory deprivation. And I was in there for 5 minutes and I was like, dude, I mean, this is cool, but what am I going to do for the next hour? And I swear, the next thing I knew, the kind of lights slowly come on and the music came up to bring you out of it, because it just flew by. Like, I generally thought an hour is going to be too long. I thought if I could have done a half hour session, I would have tried that. But an hour flew by, and it's such a rare thing now. Whether you're at home or, you know, in bed, even one of, you know, literally moments before I'm falling asleep, I'm checking my phone or the TV's on or a light's on, or even at my place, there's cars going past outside. There's all sorts of things. So it's so rare that you have an opportunity to have that complete a relaxation and removal of senses. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I wanted to talk about it because I heard about it on another podcast. I was concerned because in America, Joe Rogan started talking about these, and basically his podcast is huge. It's huge. And he launched a lot of it. Even the guy at Floatworks, which is near Canary Wharf, was saying if a dude comes in, 8 out of 10 times they've heard about it on the Joe Rogan podcast. But yeah, I just wanted to talk about that, and because I found it fascinating. I'm glad I got around to trying it out. They're not a sponsor of the show or anything. I've been listening to a lot of the Stone Cold Steve Austin podcast recently, and when he has a guest on, he spends 15, 20 minutes at the start just talking about what he's been up to and his time. And I often forget that I've got a following as well. As odd as that sounds, I think of every podcast as you're tuning in purely for the amazing and interesting guests, and I forget that a few of you might be interested in what the fuck I've been up to. So yeah, I thought I'd add a bit of that at the beginning to give you a bit of insight. In fact, let's add some more. Just really quickly, I had a few weeks ago, I had some discussion on Facebook about vegetarianism and meat eating, because I posted a picture of some meat. Just, I genuinely didn't mean to offend anyone. I literally woke up thinking, man, I love meat. And I posted that. And I woke up this morning thinking, man, I love meat. So here's some meat. But it offended a lot of people. So I posted a one of vegetables, because I genuinely also love vegetables. And a big discussion I went on, and I didn't want to get into it too much, because again, I had a lot going on that day and a lot going on in my life in general at that time. So I didn't want to get into it too much, but I discussed with a few people in messages the fact that, again, I'm completely pro. I'm happy for you to be a vegetarian. I'm happy for you to be a vegan. I happen to be a meat eater, and a lot of people were saying that how can you eat meat? Or basically, I didn't get around to explaining properly. I'm an animal a lover and a meat eater, and I'll explain that. A lot of people are like, well, you can't. You either love animals or you don't eat meat. I disagree with that. In many ways, and again, this is going to sound attacking, in many ways, I feel it's more, in some ways, I have more respect for animals than those that don't eat them because they love them. And I'll explain that, because in my mind, I still very much see humans as just another animal. I've discussed this before with my mates. My mate Tom, I won't let me talk about it with him because he feels it's too depressing. But to the extent that I'm fine with the idea of the human race being wiped out, because animals become extinct all the time. I honestly don't think on a global scale or molecular scale or anything else, it would be that big a deal if we got to a point where we wiped out. I believe another animal, another creature, organism would then take a chance and evolve over however long and have their go at it. So my belief is that we're just another animal. We happen to be an animal that it's in our nature and in our genetics to eat meat. Equally, I don't get mad at a lion for eating a zebra. It doesn't infuriate me. It doesn't make me angry in any way. So yeah, that's kind of, I could go on for hours and hours, but that's kind of my explanation of why I'm a meat-eating animal lover. I obviously know and agree that there are huge issues with some of the way that animals are farmed or meat is got and all sorts of things like that. Again, it's weird that a lot of people who say that are also anti-hunting. I believe the ideal situation would be we all hunt our own food and eat our own of food. That would be my ideal. That would genuinely be my ideal situation. That anything that is killed, anything that is killed at all, is eaten. So there's a process for it. We don't have this over farming or over stockpiling or chemicals or any of these other more ugly areas. That, which again, I get everyone's point on that. I'm going to get so much hate on Facebook and Twitter for saying any of this. But yeah. Anyway, I'm sure a load of you will be mad as hell at me for that. But, you know, you do you, I'll do me. I think the reason I was saying it's kind of more disrespectful is it feels like you're saying that we're above animals because you're saying we need to pat them on the head and look after them. It's like, well, no, in my mind, we're a predator. And in many ways, the way we've evolved our cities is we've removed a lot of natural predators. It's why in many countries and in many areas there is laws on the fact that you have to do a certain amount of hunting and culling. And again, I think that's perfectly natural in places. There's places in America where at certain points of year you have a legal obligation to kill a certain amount of whatever animal it may be. It may be bears, it may be anything, per capita, or pigs is the major one, actually, pigs, because the way we've built our societies up, we've removed a lot of their natural predators. So pigs and wild boars don't know not to just fuck and reproduce, you know, and in general, society nature has a cap on that. In everyone has its natural predators. The way we've changed that and made taken ourselves out of the food chain completely kind of has fucked all that up. So there's a certain amount that needs to be balanced out. Again, I'm not trying to make anyone mad. I'm just trying to discuss this openly and honestly, and I'm regretting it already. So let's get on to the podcast. This week, as I mentioned, it's JT John Tolley from Banquet Records. He's an amazing dude. I've been familiar with him for a long time and familiar with Banquet Records for a long time. We will explain more in the podcast, but they have become, considering their one store in Kingston, they have become a key part of most people's album releases and campaigns. And that's Kingston upon Thames, not Kingston, Jamaica. And it's because of the way they do it. Similar to the Prince Charles in many ways, they've turned around and gone, right, we can't compete in certain ways, so we're going to use our strengths, wisely. So that's what this is. So enjoy this, episode 48 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And we have begun. I'm here with John Tolley, or JT. I don't know. I'm not familiar with calling you John Tolley. That's only because of Twitter. You know, I'm used to JT. But
JT is quicker to type. I've always used that.
Yeah. So, and you run Banquet Records, and that's certainly how I met you, and numerous other things that you do. So, how are you doing? You well?
Yeah, good. Busy, always busy, but well.
Yeah, I just popped in the store to. I mean, we've now come to the Hippodrome, which is where you run your club night, New Slang as well, which we'll get round to. But I just popped into the store and it was interesting to see boxes and boxes and boxes of vinyl. So you've got something particularly good going on at the moment.
That's right. I mean, there's always lots going on, but as vinyl has become a bit of a revival of sorts, and more significantly, as labels have picked up on that, there's a lot of reissues coming through. And there's a lot of bands where we do the UK supply of the American label's release. So one just came in, which is brand new, Deja Entendre, which is a big one. We've done 2,500 of those. But wow. So there's boxes everywhere. But you can't cut any corners about trying to ship out vinyl, which people are going to love and nurture for ages.
Yeah. So it's got to be in good condition. You've got to look after it. I've just, this is coming out the week after B. Dolan's new album drops. And we're recording it a few days before, and I've just had to announce that there's a delay on that. And that's because, again, it's weird, the vinyl revival, because it's very much a thing, but it's also a bit of a battle at the moment, because it's still, I don't know, I feel it had its boom on independence, and then it's dropped off a little bit, but there's still a lot of independence. You've got a desire to do this, so you want to put stuff out on vinyl. But, yeah, I mean, the problem I had was the first ones that came through, weren't they had a they had a slight skip on some record. It wasn't even on all record players, but I was like, no, I'm not, you know, it has to be the top quality. And it takes a long time to get vinyl done. And
yeah, I mean, there's massive delays in pressing plants, and there was, you know, in amongst Record Store Day, which is a celebration of record shops, but significantly of vinyl, there was a lot of talk about the downside of Record Store Day being this, being that indie labels particularly have such a backlog of putting up, of getting their records pressed. And one thing which we'll probably come on to is we're a record label as well as a shop. Yeah. And so we have that same problem whilst benefiting from the other side of it.
Yeah,
as well.
Completely. I mean, it's a beautiful situation on your part, to say that any annoyance that you're getting from that is placated, because you're also getting the benefits from it. But it's a big thing at the moment as well, that a lot of, I'm not sure if it's HMV, I'm sure it's something, it's somehow tied into HMV, but a lot of the major labels are doing these huge runs of reissues, which means they've got big deals locked on with the pressing plants at the moment, which means again huge backlogs and delays for us smaller labels to get things through.
Yeah, it's a constant battle, but you know, this is proof of it there, but as an independent retailer, as much as we want to support a lot of the sort of small and new emerging artists, one of the things we'll sell the most of is the represses of people like Bowie and Led Zepp and stuff like that. That's still a thing which people buy, soundtracks, like the Jurassic Park soundtrack selling loads this week.
Oh, and it's, I might have to come and buy that on my way back through.
That's a beautiful thing to have, but it does put everything else behind in the queue a little bit.
I mean, again, I think all of that, and the way I like, whenever I have delays on things like that, I'll write a nice personal message explaining it, and people are generally fine with it, because as much as a delay is annoying, I love vinyl. I'm excited that all these things are coming out, and whether they're coming out on my label or not, it's still like, I can't get that mad if there's delays because there's so much demand at the pressing plants to make these beautiful things.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I'm mad at that.
The difference in 2015, I guess, is that people who are picking up records I want them in parallel with how they listen to it, and it might not actually be, I can't listen to the record until I get the vinyl in my hands, because it might be they're streaming it, or they've got the download which comes instantly when they order the record.
Exactly.
And so the vinyl is more a piece of art to have and to hold and to keep forever.
Yeah.
And how you actually listen to it might be a different way. I mean, we've all had the download codes with our records and put you on the iPod. So I think that what you said there is what we do as a business and a label, but also just what you should do as humans is just try and express a message to people.
Yeah, just understand and be okay. But it is bizarre. You've made a great point there, that the vinyl revival, a lot of it isn't necessarily a revival of people are listening to vinyl.
Yep.
It's definitely a revival of people buying vinyl and cherishing vinyl, but I don't think it's like, oh, there's been this big switch of people. It's the same. I have the same with DVDs. I've got so many DVDs now that I buy because they're films I love, and it's kind of, number one, I want to support it, and number two, I want to have it in my collection. I want it in my wall of DVDs or Blu-rays to say, here's things I like.
Absolutely, and that works. I mean, we expect people who are really into music and have been for years and decades to have that kind of mentality. But one thing which I think is quite important to express is that there's like new people into this as well. Like, for them, it's not a vinyl revival. It's new. Vinyl's new. And so at Christmas, one of our biggest sellers was the Taylor Swift album on vinyl, which was something we never saw coming.
No.
And it's a great thing to give as a present, in a way that a CD maybe less so, and an MP3 certainly less so.
Yeah, of course. That's crazy. I can't even imagine. Yeah. But again, it's a big album. It's huge, and it's going down. It is one that I love or hate Taylor Swift. I mean, personally, I've got a penchant for some of her work. I've posted that online before, and people have been fucking furious. But that is what it is. But I love or hate her, she is someone that I know. I've got metaler friends on Facebook who will admit to liking Taylor. And you know, she is someone who's broken a lot of them boundaries down, as weird as that is. So
yeah, for sure,
it's the perfect crossover artist, right?
Yeah, and also
I've just said that Taylor Swift is the perfect crossover artist. I don't want that taken out of context and quoted. But
yeah, no, that's a soundbite right there. But I think I don't think there should ever be guilty pleasures in music. I think if you like something, you just like it, and it's not anything to be, oh, I'm a bit embarrassed, but I actually like the song. Like, awesome, that's a song, and it's there's an argument to say that writing a perfect pop song is harder than writing a new punk song, you know.
Completely. There's been times on tour where I've had an amazing back catalogue of kind of 80s and 90s punk or post-hardcore, amazing stuff. And I've listened on loop to the Cyndi Lauper greatest hits because she's written some amazing pop songs. And it's like there's and again, there's no shame in that. It's in a way because of what you said there, because of the nature of guilty pleasures, and wanting to actively counterbalance that. I'll talk more about the less credible stuff, I guess. And I mean, I even put Prince in there in some way because it's he's writing pop, it's funk, it's pop. But so your Prince, your Cyndi Lauper, your all people like that, it's fine to enjoy.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about obviously Banquet Records and the scene that I feel you guys have built. But before we get to that, can we talk about growing up and what, you know, were you part of much of a scene? Are you originally from Kingston? And
yeah.
And so, how was the music, alternative music scene at that point?
Yeah, sure. I guess I came into it maybe a little bit later than some, but obviously you're talking in a kind of a world where you weren't exposed to music in the same way that today's kids are. So I grew up on the outskirts of Kingston, but I went to school in Kingston, and it was actually the shop, as it was Beggar's Banquet, which was in Kingston, which I started going to. A little bit scared walking into an independent record shop the first time. I was way more comfortable going to like the HMVs and Virgins and getting stuff. But so I was kind of through friends at school, we turned onto bands like, I don't know, Blur and Smashing Pumpkins and kind of like, you know, stuff which you would loosely call like alternative music. But it was through going to what was Beggar's Banquet that I decided, I discovered more a kind of an alternative, an underground scene, a subculture,
completely.
A different kind of music. And that's when I sort of realised that what punk rock was, it wasn't so much a kind of a fashion or a look. It was like an actual world of music, which I'd only really seen on like Punkorama type CDs.
Yeah, completely. There was far more of an ethic to it rather than a specific chord progression, even, or a limited chord progression.
So that was kind of maybe sort of 17, 18, as you're hitting the sort of sixth form or whatever, and you're trying to sort of discover who you are, and then through university years. But yeah, I was always kind of loosely into radio friendly indie and alternative stuff, but I'd say that the discovery of this subculture, which I then found, was what sort of got me hooked. And maybe because I was hooked so late, then that became my life from that point, really.
Again, it's never a bad thing. I'm convinced that the reason I've been able to maintain a solid career in music is I started, kind of had my break or really started around 24, 25. So, yeah, I messed about in local bands at a younger age, but doing it properly, I started 24, 25. So as soon as I came in, I had more of a grown-up head on it and a grown-up outlook on it. So that birth into it at a later age kind of can make you appreciate it a little bit more and have that excitement and appreciation. So when did you... Actually, before we get to that, let's talk about the fact that there is a genuinely different feel and respect from going into an HMV and going into an independent a record store. And again, I think that's heightened a lot over the years. I think, and this is only my loyalty of being an HMV worker for 5-6 years, there was a point where I feel it was a tiered system. I feel your record stores, all the staff knew, you know, everything about our records, but it was a little bit intimidating.
Yep.
Your HMVs, it wasn't intimidating, but there were people who worked there that knew about shit, that would have piercings and bright hair, and you'd go, all right, I can ask them and get some recommendations. And then your Virgins or things like that were more, it felt like this was just a shelf stocked.
Right.
With CDs. I'm going to, if I know what I want and it's big, I'll go there and buy it. It felt like HMV had the back catalogue and the knowledge. The record stores had the complete history at the drop of a hat. So yeah, how was that? And was that the feeling?
Well, it's really hard. It's really hard for me to be objective because I'm so tied up in it.
But, of course.
If you take us back to the late 90s, I guess it was in Kingston, there was 9 record shops at the same time.
Wow.
So we had 3 dance shops, 2 indie shops, and there was a Tower, and there was an R Price, and there was a Virgin and HMV at different times.
See, I've
2 R Prices at the same time.
Damn.
And so there was a lot to choose from. I think, yeah, like what you're saying there, it's unfortunate, but it does sort of go to territory that some people are intimidated going to an independent record shop. One of the things that we've tried to do from day one since taking it over and owning it is to, or Banquet that is, yeah. Is to try and break down these barriers, to try and like make people feel welcome there.
Yeah,
and that's how that is. But I don't really know if I ever saw it as tiered. I think I just saw that one shop was better at one thing and one at another. Yeah, and so, you know, some shops might be better at price, some shops might be better at knowledge and back catalogue.
Exactly
stuff.
That. I used to, I had some mates who worked in a DVD shop near, and this is a confession that I'm glad I'm not in HMV anymore because they'd be furious, but I had some mates who worked in a rival DVD shop, but it was an independent one. And when, like, it was at the time when, like, Harry Potter films were, like, the biggest thing you could get in anywhere. They, like, as the DVDs came out, they were the big deal. And they'd often put them out a day early to get those extra sales and all that. And we would send people around to try and buy one, to catch them so that we could report them. And I was management at the time, and I'd just pop off to the toilet and text my mate saying someone's coming round to check. Because in my mind, again, it's weight in it. HMV can buy it in huge bulk and have a huge price advantage. So independent record stores need to have their own ways of fighting it up and having their own advantages, right?
But I think it's quite important to say, like, you know, what you're saying there, but where we are right now, HMV is in no way the enemy to any independent stores, and it's really important that there is a high street chain which sells physical music, because without that, it might be that the labels are like, okay, so I'll tell you what, let's just give it to Amazon and that's it.
Again, I think that's been a huge thing that happened in recent years, like when HMV did nearly fold, it was that kind of thing of, and again, I got it from mates who work in independent stores and things like that, who had seen them as the enemy for so long.
Yeah.
And then when Virgin went, everyone's like, yeah, fuck them. And it was like, oh, damn, there's only one left. If they go, then, what's going to happen? Because that is still one of the major reasons and resources and abilities for labels to press
absolutely
physical stuff, even if it's to end up sitting on their shelves. It's that initial shipment going out.
And significantly, the people who work there are in the main music fans or video fans or games fans, but still fans of what we would loosely call creative arts.
Completely.
And also, I had a point in my mind which I completely lost.
That's
the key thing. And
yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's that weird thing of, it's not until it almost went that I think people truly appreciated it. It's not, for some reason there is a massive difference between a walking in a shop and looking at stuff than going on Amazon or going on wherever. And one of the things, I mean, you mentioned about the intimidation factor and how Banquet tend to counter that. I mean, I feel one of the ways has always been the way you'll have your recommends and things like that. They're never in a snooty kind of hipster manner. They're always kind of really, should check this out. It's pretty decent. It's, you know, it's okay to have not heard of it.
Yeah.
It's fine.
What we try and do is never to sort of try and persuade someone to buy something. What we try and do is persuade someone to put it on their radar. And from that point, like, hey, this band exists, you should check it out. If you like these bands, then you should see what this band's about. And at that point, they can be like, hey, that's not for me. Or they can be like, oh, wow, I didn't know this.
Yeah.
But also, and again, in 2015, it's a different world, but a lot of the time, the people who are coming in know exactly what they want. They just want you to be able to serve them with the thing that they already want.
Yeah.
So the need to create a demand isn't there in the same way, but because the demand's there, a lot of the kids who come in, and adults, I use that kids, the term kids wrongly there, but they will be more clued up on their favourite bands than we will about those bands. So one of the things we get from behind the till, which is why I never want to stop working downstairs and over the counter, is you find out so much more from the customers.
Yeah,
and so you get knowledge from the customers, which you can then use to the next people who would be like-minded.
Yeah.
And it really is that which I think, as long as we have that relationship with customers, we can keep providing these gigs and these records and these exclusives and what have you, and just serving people. And as kind of preachy as that sounds, that is actually a thing which the people who work at Banquet and most indies, I think you'll find, have that in them.
You know? I mean, it's hugely true. I think you wouldn't expect, and we'll get on to when you kind of took on Banquet, because I want to hear that story as well, but you wouldn't looking on a map,
Kingston-upon-Thames shouldn't be a key demographic or area for record releases. Yet every label I've worked with and been involved with knows that it can be absolutely key, particularly on release week, because of the scene. I think that you guys have been a huge part in building here, in educating the local scene in music. And again, it's great that that also comes back and comes full circle. But so was that always a conscious thing of, right, we're not just here to provide a service, we're here to inform upon that service, and whether that be with the club night, the in-stores, the gigs, the, you know, the store itself?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a long answer and there's a lot of parts to it.
Let's do it.
But we at Banquet, when, you know, I started working at Beggars Banquet before we took it over, and the people who worked there before me, everyone, because you earn rubbish money working in a record shop, or, you know, not what a lot of people deserve, you had to get money from other ways. And so you found that people, there's a lot of people DJing because they were, and again, it's pre sort of everyone having MP3s, but they were the ones who had all the cool records before everyone else. So they would be the ones DJing the club night. So there was a kind of an idea about promotion anyway, be it the guy who liked the dance music the most would be doing the house night, and then there was a punk night and an indie night and all these things. And so we had a kind of head start there. But the person who gave me my job, Mark, who he eventually left to manage 100 Reasons and take them on to their sort
Wicked.
Of big days of Brixton Academy and the like, he was already putting on gigs of these bands which I didn't really know of, but I wanted to check out. And because the guy from the record shop said, oh, cool, I was like, well, I'm going to check them out.
Yeah, I'll pay attention to that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that was a way which I think, and we heard this on your recent podcast, but it's a bit of a shame that today's youth doesn't really have that whole excitement and investing in an item in the same way.
But, completely. Me and POS were discussing that thing of when you've physically invested in something, it means that bit more to you. You've got that. And again, when I was growing up, I could afford a couple of CDs a month if that. So, but it meant that Reef Replenish was getting played constantly. Because at the time I was like, I bought a Reef Replenish and, do you remember the band Live?
Oh, yeah.
So I bought their two albums and I knew them in and out. And looking back now, there's ups and downs on there, but it was because that was all, like, you know, it meant the world to me. Yeah. Whereas now I think I might have skipped past some songs and all that. But continue.
So there was always gigs going on in Kingston, partly because the people behind the till were doing their own separate things. And so there was gigs going on in a venue which at the time wasn't used to putting on live music, which they made into a venue which could house live music, which was the Peel, and that became actually like a staple for like touring punk bands. Eventually, it's now knocked down, which is a sad time. So there was always this going.
But yeah, it was definitely it was on the map, which is bizarre because Kingston is one of those places that it's two outskirts. It's a risky one to play because you might draw from your main London gig.
Yeah,
it's not far enough out. It's that weird middle point of, should we do this? But as the scene built,
that's always the battle. And when we're trying to persuade bands to come to Kingston with their agents, it is typically, well, we can't do London and Kingston, so sometimes we have to persuade them in other ways. But we wanted to put on gigs in Kingston because we want bands in our hometown. And like, trek into London, it doesn't quite have the same like emotional involvement as in your hometown with all your crew and your friends. So that was a driving force there. So some of, at the time, the sort of touring DIY punk bands like Cap Down and Spy versus Spy and those kind of shows would sell out, 250 people selling out the biggest venue we had at the time, and that was like a real part of something. You felt you were part of something when you were there with these touring bands. So we always had the idea of putting on club nights and putting on shows, and then as and when, and we'll probably talk about the mechanics of this, but as and when we took over Banquet, what we tried to do is we were selling records, and outside of our day job, we were putting on gigs and putting on club nights. So we tried to put them all under the same umbrella.
Yeah, that makes tons of sense.
Yeah, and because the person who goes to gigs is the person who buys records. So why not get him involved and try and make it all part of the same thing? So the driving force was like, hey, this is music. We should all be we should all be trying to celebrate this and involve each other. But if we were trying to express it to a bank manager, we'd be talking about like diversifying within music and having a 360 degree approach to music consumerism. Yeah. But it's not that. It's just a vibe. It's just like you as a music fan, you should
completely. Like, and I definitely think it's an ethic and an idea that a label's at a point took on in the wrong way with their attempts at 360 deals, because they tried to do a similar thing but made it a financial thing of, right, shit, if people are going to stop buying stuff, we now need to sign artists and get every bit of, or get a cut of everything that they do, which isn't the point. Whereas the beauty of the reverse side of it, of your kind of 360 deal, is rather than getting a cut of everything, it's putting everything in one bowl. So you're going, right, everything feeds itself and feeds each other. So the club nights and gigs are feeding the store, and the store is promoting, like, get this band, and, you know, and seeing
absolutely
it all through.
And there were sometimes, like, back in the day where I'd be putting on gigs and I would lose, like, 200, 300 quid, and I didn't know how I would eat for the next few days.
Yeah.
But as it is now, we can be a bit more risky, and sometimes we can lose a big amount of money, considerably more than that, and no one's going bust, you know, because there's different revenue streams, and we can take more risk and do more things. And sometimes we do things which we know are going to lose money, but we think are just a good thing worth doing for, like, the local town.
Perfect. So let's rewind a bit. How did you go from nervously walking into to Beggar's Banquet for the first time to working there to then, you know, taking over?
So I went to university at Loughborough, which was a pretty poor area for music. The best things about Loughborough was that it was near other places. Yeah. I mean, the actual town itself was bad. So because there wasn't much of a music scene, I started an indie night there. And that was kind of how I got involved in DJing and promoting. And then when we came back to Kingston through the holidays, I was helping the guys at the shop who were doing their thing.
I think indie nights are such a good gateway and starting point, because so many... Not to hate on anyone, because I've done it as well myself, but you don't need an awful lot of skill to DJ at an indie night. You just need some good tunes.
Absolutely.
It's not that kind of, right, you need this pressure of you need to be able to mix and do this and that. It's like, them kids just want to hear the right songs, and that's that.
I think in that context, you're a selector rather than a DJ.
It's
just about picking the right tunes. Yeah. But the actual skill of pressing play, you know, my mum could do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But she never has yet. I'll try and persuade her.
Let's move that up the priority list.
So where was it? So I left university, didn't really know what to do. Started working at Beggars on a part-time basis because it was quite fun, but, you know, it wasn't a real job. Left there, got a real job, which earned a bit of money, but was a bit boring. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the guy who was doing the sort of punk and indie buying at the shop, he left to... take on 100 Reasons management full-time, which was, it was... you know, 12, 13 years ago now.
Yeah.
And they were a band who...
When they had supported every metal band or hardcore band that came over for years, and then were doing their own huge shows.
And at that time, like, they really were groundbreaking. I mean, like, you wouldn't flick through Kerrang and find any UK rock bands apart from maybe Muse.
Yeah.
Like, that was, like, it was the new beginning of, like, an alternative rock band.
They're the band I've seen the most... without paying to go and see, if that makes sense. And again, I don't mean that as an insult at all. It was an easy bonus that if I was going to see the Mars Volta or whoever was over, I'd get to see 100 Reasons too, and that'd be a genuine, like, we'd get there early for that. I don't mean that as any insult, but they were making waves when everything else that you were into of that genre was American.
Yeah, and they really did open the way for a lot of other bands, whether or not they realise it.
Yeah.
So the guy was left and was like, do you want this job? And I was like, I don't really know, I'm quite happy at the moment, I'm getting a bit of money, and I'm trying to save to buy a house. And he was like, but then we kind of worked out that if I didn't do that job, didn't know who was going to do that job, and everything about the local music scene and the gigs and all this stuff, which was my only social life, you know, that would fall apart.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, not pressured into it, but I knew that if
I
we didn't...
I love that. It's like, do you want this job? I mean, you can, but if you don't, you've got nowhere to go out anymore and nothing to do. So, it's up to you. You have the job or not,
but it kind of felt
your social life is fucked if you don't take this job.
Yeah, maybe, but it was more the actual idea that if we want these gigs to continue and like something which we thought was like quite significant at the time. So I took this job on and like didn't really know how long it would last, a couple of years or whatever, but I found it quite fun and quite interesting.
Yeah.
After not very long, the parent company, Beggars Banquet, Beggars Group, which owned the retail arm of what they did, decided to close the retail arm. So They sold it to the then boss for very cheap, a nothing amount, and we took on he took on the record shop as was, and it was 2 years after that that it was running out of money, and we were like a week from going bust. Like we had no stock to sell, so we couldn't get money in, and then we couldn't pay the bills because we weren't getting any sales. And it was a bleak time. I hadn't been paid for like 8 months, and I was getting by off like my DJ money.
Yeah,
and you know that was fine in a way because I thought the bigger picture was important. But as we were going bust, my we worked out a way to buy it off the then boss, which was that's 10.5 years ago, and we bought it for like a very small amount, but took on very significant debts.
Yeah, of course.
And then it became the Banquet that we know today. So that was 10.5 years ago, and since it became Banquet, all the stuff, like I was saying earlier, all the stuff that we did outside of the shop became a part of the shop.
That's perfect. You see, I was going to say, how did you pull yourself out of that situation then? Because you're taking on a live grenade there, effectively. If it's very much you're out of stock and this, but I guess one of those methods would be to pull in all of the resources and make it
absolutely
make it one thing.
And we did have a cash injection when we borrowed some money because we knew that, having worked in the business and doing the accounts at that time for 2 years, I could see that if we got that money, we could do this and we could do this.
Speculate to accumulate.
Yeah. Well, and it worked to a point, you know, but it wasn't as immediate as we hoped. And there was a lot of work and a lot of people doing a lot of work for no money and friends getting involved and people who were doing commercial work for hundreds of pounds for like graphic design stuff, helping us out as mates and stuff, and we really did pull on a lot of favours.
That's wicked.
And then we took it over, and it's been the beginning of something different from that point.
Yeah, it seems to have just keep growing and growing. Let's talk quickly about how the digital side has grown. Again, I'm jumping ahead here because I want to get back to the in stores and all the different people you've had. But that's kind of, I think we should make people wait a bit for that because that's the beauty there. But let's talk about the digital side of it and how that's changed, because a lot of independent record stores have fallen under the wave of digital record sales. Banquet seems to be the one have gone, no, we're going to supplement everything with that. And that's going to, as I think it has now, become at least equal a part of our business and size of our business to be selling records online. And again, it's something that is quite simple and straightforward, but I mean, HMV I believe have dropped their digital a web store now,
right now,
and things like that. So you know, there's a fair few people, so all you've got really is Amazon, who a lot of people are against because of their tax evasion and things like that. A lot of people are for because of the ease and the price and everything else, but yeah, you've put yourself up there as one of the key options and outlets for buying online.
I think from day one, we've always tried to treat our customers as music fans, and we as music fans should know how they are. Yeah. So we were never trying to pretend that we didn't buy MP3s or whatever. Yeah. So we don't want digital to be the enemy. And as websites were growing, there was a few shops who were kind of trying to be like, oh, the internet's the enemy, but we were never that. And I think the shops that are left that are doing well are also those ones who sort of embraced the internet as a wide term.
In many ways, it took an ethos and an ethic and everything that was very much loved in Kingston. It took that global, I guess, in many ways. It meant it was now accessible. You didn't have to come all the way to Kingston to thumb through your records.
Yeah.
And you could do it from...
And we've always tried to make the website... And we've always tried to make the website an online version of the shop.
Yeah.
So the idea is when you go straight into the shop, you see the front racks of some of the big stuff, and you can go and have a look at some of the other things, and then you can flick through. And so that's the vibe of the shop. And so there's personal recommendations there as well, and maybe a photo of that band played the shop.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. We want it to be sort of warts and all in a way. Yeah. We're not trying to compete with Amazon. We're trying to be an online version of ourselves. So come in and there'll be a personal opinion there, but it won't be a snobby one. It'll try to be sort of, hey, if you like this, you like this. And the same way that if we see a customer come in who likes a particular kind of band, we can point them the way of this. But it's not like an algorithm. It's not like a an Amazon-esque customers who bought this will buy this. It's a little bit more, hey, this has the same feel of this. And so I think sometimes people get too involved in analysis and a kind of an automated approach where you need to keep that human aspect to the shop, to the online stuff, to the gigs, and be real people running a real record shop, because otherwise you're trying to compete with Amazon, which isn't what we do.
I mean, it's exactly how people like POS and Sage Francis and so many others have appealed to so many punk kids and metal kids, because in an algorithm they wouldn't at all, because they're hip hop. But in the reality, in the feel of them, in the DIY nature, and same with me and Dan over the years, like our crowd has always been hugely varied in who they are. Yet you probably wouldn't put an algorithm to put any of these people in the same room together. Yet they're all there enjoying it, because there's some intangible element there that. That ties it all together.
I utterly believe that punk is a lifestyle rather than a music type. So if you're like punk minded, DIY minded, you know, you can have the same kind of vibe with like a punk kid putting on a band as a grime artist in a different venue as almost like as artists, like visual artists in a different environment and like skateboarding shops, how they deal with like an independent market in their world and against like the corporates of Nike SB or something. And there's so many parallels all the way.
I mean, I'd say the most, or one of the most punk rock things to come out in recent years have been Odd Future. And again, there's love and hate. There's been stuff I've liked and stuff I've not liked. But on the punk ethic and idea, there is punk as you can possibly get, yet they probably haven't got a single guitar on, or a lot of them wouldn't have a single guitar or instrument on any of the records. But
and it's something that I've witnessed right up and close personally is JME, who had an album out two months ago, and like he's self-managed, and well he runs his thing stuff himself. I don't know if self-managed is the right word. And he was like, shall I do he put on Twitter, shall I do a signing at in Kingston, or is it a bit leave it? And people replied to him saying, yeah, you should come down. So he did a signing in the shop, which was quite sick, you know, good idea. And then we had this PA sitting in the shop, as we do for installs, and we were like, hey, do you want to play some songs? And he's like, yeah, why not? And then and that was like a real sort of punk money thing, like where he just did it, just got on with it. And then we had like the best time in a kind of, and Skepta came down and said hello and was vocals on a track, and that was just a real kind of spirit of DIY. And so this is cross music, but it's the mindset behind it all, which I'm sure you can appreciate.
Completely. So let's get into the in-stores, because I think there's something that Banquet is synonymous with and has a great history of. Again, it becomes a key part in a lot of people's campaigns, even when they get to a point where they're bigger than it needing to be, because of having, I mean, I've done at least 3 in stores and been there for the War and Peace one with you guys. And it's always just, it's a buzz. So when did that come about, and what was the idea behind that?
Well, at where we are right now, there's loads of different reasons why people might want to do an in-store. Yeah. Like some it's about, or a gig in general, because we kind of view the in-stores as a part of the gig. So some might want to do it for money, some might want to do it to sell a few albums, particularly in week one, and we'll talk more about why charts are important. Some might just want to do something that's cool.
Yeah.
And you've got to, again, understand the thinking behind it. So say recently, Laura Jane Grace of Against Me did an in-store at the shop for no other reason than why not, you know? And we've seen stuff like Newfound Glory when they played the Fighting Cocks, like a massive pop punk band playing a 120 cap room. They did it just for fun, like didn't tell anyone, just landed off a plane and came and played like a tiny pub. But so the in-stores work for the bands for a variety of ways, and you need to kind of deal with that. For the customer, it's just cool, you know. There's nothing more than that. Like very rarely do we ever kind of be like, oh, how much money can we make off this? It's not that. It's like, oh my god, we can have this band playing in a tiny little record shop. And for some of the time, it's particularly for, I mean, over 18s are quite blessed in Kingston because there's quite a lot of gigs going on, but the under 18s in Kingston, it's a real, sometimes it's their first ever concert, you know, and they can get to see, like, you know, bands like, I don't know, Bastille or Swim Deep or you know, like we say, JME there and all different types, you know. You lot.
I was going to say, it's worrying to think of it for anyone's first concert, because they're often quite the old, like it's not like the biggest sound system.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, you know, but as I said, it's all about the vibe and the atmosphere. And I think you're right there. It's engaging a youth crowd, like we've done in stores, where it's, in fact, a banquet in store is one of the only times I've censored myself on a song, because I think it was on Introduction. It came up to the C word, and there was a little kid on his dad's shoulders, and I literally made eye contact just before, and I couldn't do it. And it's like, I don't believe in censorship. I believe in blah, blah. But in that moment, I was like, man, we're like almost face to face, and this is just too much. So it's that beautiful intimacy, I think, that
oh, it's brilliant, and then that ties in, and so we treat the in stores as like a kind of one way of having these intimate up close and personal gigs. But there's other ways we can do that as well. So this week just gone, Monday just gone, Lucy Rose has her album out this week, and you know, she's a kind of like alt folk pop kind of thing. It's way more bandy than it used to be. And so we did that one in the local church, like a beautiful thousand-year-old building in the middle of town. And having her play there, all seated, like 300 people coming and watching that. And again, it's like, because it's all ages and no alcohol, and it's nice for people from like 12 to 60 to come and watch a new artist. And you get the same sort of buzz off that and that you do from an in-store, because it's about... it's about changing to the needs of, in this case, the artist. What the artist wants to do there is to sell a lot of albums and also have this like special, unique feeling gig. So that ticks all those boxes. Yeah. And for us, it's really good because we're providing that service and we get to watch bands we like.
Yeah, I mean, completely. And it is a real unique experience because it is intimate. It is, again, the weird thing, it's generally in daylight.
Yeah.
You know, which is weird for a gig. You're generally in some dark room or there is no alcohol. There's no drunk people. It's kind of, it's an odd thing. At points it can be jarring because you can be really going for it and then realise everyone is just standing there thoroughly enjoying it.
Mm.
But dude, you're sober and in a bright room as if you're going to be going, as if you're going to be losing your shit. It's understandable. But yeah, it builds that beautiful thing. But and let's talk about as well the benefits of the way you'll often sync them in with pre-orders, because particularly for smaller labels and independent artists, pre-orders... and getting those first week record sales can be a huge deal. So Banquet, I think, were genius in convincing agents and labels, essentially, because the artists, most of them, will be like, yeah, cool, let's do this. Whereas to approach a labels and agents and say, look, we'll do this, that if you pre-order it, you get priority entry and things like that, so that, and you'll get it signed on the day and all this kind of thing. Kind of all ties together as a beautiful package, right?
Yeah, and it's one thing that we do, and you need to be able to own and run a record shop and also be putting on gigs in the town. And that's why it's quite a hard thing to replicate, because unless you have the experience of putting on gigs in your town and having that shop, it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But we already said earlier about the obvious connection between people who buy music and go to record shops. So that thing... that would be obvious.
Yeah,
people who buy music and go to gigs, so... that exists, and not recognizing that exists and trying to do something with it to sell some albums is obviously like something we can do. Now, the importance of getting like for a lot of us, we don't buy music because it's popular or because it's in the charts, and there seems to be a kind of, it's wrong to think that what we want to do is to have big pop stars visit the shop. It's not that particularly, it's not about how popular they are, but what it is if bands have an album out that week and it gets to number 40, say, then it'll be wrapped up in the HMVs the following week. It might get on Radio 1 daytime play or something. If it doesn't get top 40, it might not. So if we can help the band have the difference between number 40 and number 41, then that will help the band in the long-term future. If we can be the difference between number 10 and number 11, it might be the difference between Sainsbury's racking it up. So if you can talk about like indie rock bands like Circle Waves or Catfish and the Bottlemen, who've both been sort of playing recently, they get their albums wrapped up in Sainsbury's, Asda, HMV, they can sell more and it provides sustainability. And we've just spoken about how important it is to have a high street store selling physical music. If they're only selling the same music they were selling the week before, then it's not going to be for the good of the bands that we know and love.
Yeah, and it's ignorant. Again, I've had this in the past. And with the podcast, in fact, because I'll post proudly when we get to number one in the iTunes chart or top 10 or whatever. And people sometimes pick up and go, but charts aren't important. It's like... there's an element of that that's right. The actual physical thing of a chart, it doesn't really mean anything, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's nice to go to bed going, I'm the fucking number one podcast in the UK right now. I ain't going to lie, there's that element. But more importantly, with independent artists, and whether that be music or podcasts or whatever, we don't have budgets to let people know about it. And the world's a busy fucking place. So a lot of bands even, particularly with the way Facebook is now as well, I'm going in a bit too deep here, but the way Facebook is now, not all of your posts show up to everyone who follows you or likes you. All these things, you could have a lot of your fan base who don't know you've got a new album coming out. So the fact of appearing in that chart and getting wrapped in HMV or getting played on Radio 1 or all these other things, it's advertisement that we couldn't afford to buy. It's that bit. Again, we couldn't afford an advert on Radio 1. That's a fact.
Yeah.
So if you can get to that point where they have to play your song and say, this is who, that's your advert for free. So it genuinely, I think it's good to flag up the question mark occasionally over charts and how they are actually a valid and important part of these things. And if you guys can help in that, in pushing that through, then that's... it's win-win for everyone. I always get annoyed. I'm going on and on now, but people seem to think that you can't have something that's just beneficial for everyone. Mm-hmm. I've had it before. I had a guy saying to Dan after a show, saying, Pip, after every gig, I sit at the merch booth. I sell all the merch myself. I'll sign everything, have photos. And this guy, like, it's just so capitalist. It's just because you make more money. It's like, oh, for sure, it's wicked that we make more money. That's awesome. But... it's also nice to meet everyone. Also, I remember the first time I went to see Sage Francis and he was there and I could buy it off him and have it signed. It meant the world to me. So I'm benefiting. They're benefiting. Mm-hmm. It's like, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. You know? And it's the same with what you guys do. It's that, well, yeah, you get it busier. Well, you will get more sales because the band are coming there as well. But the band get more and everyone wins.
And there's two other aspects to this. Well, one is... It's sustainability for me. I think that's the most important thing, because if as a label or a publisher or an agent or whatever, you're taking the risk on bands, if you can get a return on that, then you can take more risks with those bands in the future. As a promoter here, if we can get a lot of people through the doors and the venues like us more, we can get the price down of the venue higher, and then we can get the bands in for cheaper. That's really good as well. But I think the other thing, I don't know if you've touched upon it much, but with the introduction to the Friday release date, I think that is quite dangerous for new and emerging bands.
Right.
That's just happened, and I think that we've had
B. Dolan's Kill the Wolf on the first ever international Friday release date. But what issue you made.
Well, I mean, for independent stores and HMVs, actually, there's an immediate problem, which is that we lose our natural spike in the week, that we don't have a Monday and a Saturday, which is one thing, but that only affects us. But for actual independent labels and artists, if we don't have the midweek charts and a way for artists to be... there's this new album out. Oh, wow, that's selling a lot. Oh, we didn't order enough. We'll get more in for the Wednesday, for the Thursday, and rack it out for the weekend. We're going to lose that, and it's going to be harder... we think, and as do other people, like Martin Mills from Beggars gave a speech at the ERA AGM about it too. It's going to be harder for new bands to break through to the charts. And if we're not careful, the album chart will just be exactly the same as it was 3 months ago, because it's just the same stuff selling on iTunes.
Let's go into that a little. I can give experience as an independent artist, is your independent acts and bands that have kind of just got that passionate fan base rather than being a big pop thing, have their big record sales on the day it comes out.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, our biggest chart position will be a midweek chart. Yeah. You know, when we went in, I'm guessing it was Angles, actually, when that ended up at around number 34 or 35 in the charts in the midweek, it was almost in the top 10.
Yeah.
Because we had that hardcore fan base. Now, the fact is, as the weekend comes around and as people on Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday are doing their shopping in supermarkets, are doing their, you know, whatever, that's when all the bigger pop stuff sells and pushes us all out the chart. So, but the fact is, as said, the midweek chart will make a radio station's pay a bit of attention to it. Yeah. It will make a record store's go, all right, that's sailing in the chart. And we only ordered one or two on a replenish a basis. So, yeah, it's kind of a valid point. It'll be interesting to see how it goes, I guess, because...
I mean, I think it's...
Yeah, I don't know. It's,
I think
it's not something I've thought about or discussed, really.
No, I mean, it's a thing which has been recognised, and I think the people who are driving through the Friday release date are the majors who have the more to benefit from this. But it just means that we as... independent shops, independent labels, independent artists need to come up with that next way. That next way of like using our contacts and our favours and our mates while
to make
all
that
the others.
Buzz.
Are, yeah.
And again, it's a genuine thing. Every time that we've had a high midweek position and we've then posted excitedly online and said, like, look, can you all support and come out and buy? It's not because we're trying to be greedy. It's because we're fucking excited. Again, it's so funny when people. Because I've in the past been like, oh, charts aren't important. And then when you're in a chart, it's kind of pretty fucking cool. So, you know, there's exactly that. But that genuine excitement to push your fan base on, which will be harder to get on a regular basis if you're instantly in at number 89 or, you know, or further and further because of not having that initial indie support.
Yeah, I think the key thing of this is that the music is no better or worse if it's number one or 100. It's however good the music is. But for the longevity of the artist, the more they can get exposed to more people, the more people can get turned onto it, and then they can fall in love with the band that we fall in love with too. So that's the important thing.
If you want a band to be your little secret, it probably won't be a secret that lasts long, because you can't sustain yourself on being a one person's a little secret. So, yeah, I've always wanted... It's why I love doing my Beatdown radio show and things like that, because that was all about going... Dude, you've got to hear this. This is amazing. Rather than being, well, this is my little, this is my thing. You stay away from that.
Absolutely.
So let's quickly have a bit of a run through of some of the in-stores you've had. I was looking, I mean, on the, I'm not going to say I stole it, but obviously with the podcast, I do a Polaroid every day for every episode. But on your counter, you always have a Polaroid of each person that's come in. And me and Dan are still there from 2008. So that's a pretty good... Particularly as they get turned over quite a bit.
I was in the bin,
decent...
I just got it out just today.
Yeah. Just to be polite. But I saw Charlie XCX on there, which, again, I'll be honest, I've not heard that much, but I know she's a massive deal now. I saw Will Young as a recent one.
Yeah.
But I know you've had, I mean, the Shikari lads, the King Blues lads, the, you know, a lot of different people. So who have you had that's kind of gone on to be the biggest... do you think?
I mean, this wasn't in the shop, but the hands down the biggest thing we've had is BDI. And when you're having a Liam Gallagher kind of in your shop, that's pretty crazy.
That's insane.
We've spoken earlier about like how we don't want to be snobby or whatever. So one of the things we had recently was McBusted, which was 900 people came in and out of the shop that day to meet them and get their
crazy
CD signed.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
Bastille went on to be pretty huge.
Yeah, definitely.
Laura Marling is one.
Yeah.
There's Example, and there's all sorts of bands. We do like 200 gigs a year in
that's
and around
amazing.
Town, and have done for what this is the sixth year. And so you get some which get forgotten quite quick as well.
Yeah.
But we take that Polaroid of each band that plays, and then we still get kids and adults and yourself oh my god, look at that! Oh wow!
Yeah,
and someone like Charlie XCX, which it didn't sell out. Like it was just before it kind of broke. It wasn't utterly full.
Yeah.
You know, people were like, oh wow, maybe I should pay more attention to what's going on just around the corner.
Yeah, just
so
around
that works
the corner.
As a, and again, that works out. As you implied earlier, that's how we advertise to people. We can't afford an advert in the enemy, but we can put some really cool Polaroids on our counter, and then the people who come in are like, wow, what is this place? Yeah,
this looks awesome. So I also wanted to see, are there any in-stores that spring to mind that went the most manic or got out of hand, and also who's attempted to do an in-store with the biggest setup? Because again, it's not easy to do, you know, it's a stripped down thing, but some bands will probably go, It's all right to bring an eight piece orchestra, right?
As well, I guess because people do find it hard to understand the constraints of being in a record shop. So back in the day, before I was as sure of myself as I am now, perhaps we'd had a Young Knives in store where they brought a full PA. There was like stacks touching the ceiling, and, you know, for kind of 80 people trying to fit in the shop.
Damn.
And it was the hottest day of the year, and all that power and all those bodies and all that electricity just seemed to make it hotter.
Yeah.
So that was probably the worst. But generally, people understand what we're about. Some of the fun things that have happened is we had a band called Tellison, who at that point, they just put, we released their album, so they're obviously quite strong, quite big in Kingston.
Yeah.
And they played on a real hot day, and the singer fainted mid-set, so that wasn't that wasn't the best. And recently, a band called Narwhals, who are sort of a thrashy punk band, they played, but they don't do acoustic, they don't do stripped down.
Of course they
don't. We had the full, we put the cages on the windows, and like we knew there was going to be crowd surfing, so we took all the CDs out.
Oh,
and
wow.
We were just like, go for it, lads, kind of thing. And it was, there was people crowd surfing from like 2 seconds into the set, and it was brilliant. But the amazing thing is how much every customer was like, okay, we're gonna fuck things up here, but not here. And so they were looking after the whole shop. No one touched any of the stuff on the walls.
That's
or the
wicked.
Ceiling.
I was going to say, there is a level of respect, because we've done in-stores in there that have been rammed and rowdy, and all the CDs are there, you know. It's not, there's a beauty of a beautiful feeling of community there. Again, on paper you could probably say, well, we can't do it because people will steal stuff or people will break stuff or all this kind of thing. But if you just have a little bit of faith in people and give them that and go, look, you're getting something cool here, then there seems to be that respect, right?
If anyone does dick about, then their mates tell them not to. But we very rarely, if ever, have to police anything.
Yeah.
Because there is a sense, and I think everyone has it in them, that like you try and support the things that you like.
Yeah.
And if you're watching one of your favourite bands playing in a tiny little place, then you support the place that has enabled you to do that. And we see it, and we see it from kids' parents popping in and saying, thank you so much that my girl met this guy, or that, you know, they come back and get their Christmas presents from here, even if they don't buy anything the rest of the year. It is nice.
That's
wicked. It's very rewarding, because we do work hard, we work a lot of hours, and when people are really appreciative of what you do, it makes it good.
So when was the decision to bring a new slang, the club night, into it? And that has live elements as well. It's been involved in launches, album launches and stuff like that. Was that a case of, or was that when you were bringing everything into the same pot, or was that a case of, right, the in-stores are getting too big now, we need another avenue?
It was a bit later than when we took over the shop. One of my favourite bands of all time, and it's one of my Desert Island Discs bands, Say Anything, were touring the UK, and I really wanted to book a show. And at the time, the only appropriate venue we had was The Pill, which is a capacity of 250 people. So they were like, if you can find us a room that will hold 500 people, then you can book that band. And I was like, well, how can we do this kind of thing? So I went over to the nearest big room to the banquet, which is the Hippodrome where we're sat now. And I was like, can we do this?
Literally kind of just about see it from out the door.
Absolutely.
So I like that you didn't go too far.
Yeah. I didn't have time for that. So we asked about that, and we set everything in motion, really, to try and put on bands who needed to play a bigger room. Didn't work out with Say Anything, although there was a happy ending to that story later on.
Yeah.
But we did talk about it. We did talk about the stage and hiring a PA and trying to work things out. And in the end, we took the leap to putting on something outside of our comfort zone with 100 Reasons, because they were our friends.
Yeah, of course.
The right band to start on. So we had 100 Reasons, who are quite, you know, still quite rocky and thrashy for like a nightclub kind of environment. We had them poised to play here. The day before, the singer lost his voice, so couldn't play.
Damn.
So he pulled out, and we decided to just put the support on, and then instead of having it as a gig, have a little club night afterwards, you know, just playing some indie stuff. So the unknown guy called Frank Turner decided to play, and we didn't bother hiring a PA for that one, so we stuck his mic and his guitar into the DJ mixer and stuck him through the club PA rather than us having to hire a PA.
Yeah.
And we, you know, gave him a few beers and 50 quid and thanks very much, and we had a little dance after, and there's 150 people turned up, and that was an outrageous success at the time.
Yeah.
And then we thought, hang on, that was quite fun. Why don't we try and replicate this a bit more? And inspired by club nights like White Heat and After School, we tried to make this kind of our version of it, where we had live bands, and then the things we played after the live bands were, instead of the bit between indie and electro, to try and play like the bits between indie and punk. So punk-minded artists.
Yeah.
And also sort of the biggest indie pop of the time.
Yeah.
So that's how it all began. And it's evolved quite a lot over the years. And we've since then brought in the kind of in-store idea, where you can buy the CD and you can get a ticket for certain shows. So this year, like, examples of that might include The Vaccines or The Wombats, Jamie XX, you know, so it's quite a like diverse kind of range of artists, but all with the kind of, our album's out, why don't you buy a CD, we'll give you a ticket, you can see the artists play live, you can get a CD, why wouldn't you do that? It's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And we can do like four-figure numbers of those bands.
It's wicked. I've discussed before, and not to compare Kingston to a foreign country, but I've discussed before that often when we've gone and got booked at festivals or gigs in Romania or in these different places, the fact that we're playing, people will then look into us and become fans. So it's a really weird one of, have we got a fan base there? It's like, well, no, this particular club is putting you on. They will provide you a fan base.
Yeah.
And I feel there's a similarity with Banquet, is there's a level of whatever you're putting on, there's a certain amount of people that will go, oh, let's have a look at that. Let's check that out. That's worth a look. Rather than being scanning at the beginning of the month to see who they are into to go to, more it's taking that traditional local band ethic of there's a gig on, people will come and see it, and bringing in bands from all over the world and going, right, you've not heard of these people, but because it's on, you'll check it out.
Well, that's certainly what we're trying to do, so that's awesome that it's recognised. I think you'll know more, but I think the first time you played for us was a few weeks after you played somewhere else in Kingston, which was didn't go too well.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
I think when you guys turned up here, being like, oh, I'm not so sure about this one, and then it was a blast, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing,
and set the tone for the first one.
And again, I still have people who I talk to on Twitter regularly who were at that first one and have been at each one since then in Kingston, and it's odd that there's that people around here seem to get really into it, you know, they seem to get properly invested. And again, I think it helps if you come and, you know, we're always aware that if it's going to be a good crowd or a bad crowd, that we're going to play our asses off. So I think that wins people over as well. But I mean, similarly, we had a War and Peace one here, and that worked perfectly because Buddy Peace was a former employee, so that was perfect. But again, that wasn't rammed, but man, they went crazy for it, and you know, and got into it. I think that's kind of the key with it. It's not necessarily about 80 people, cages on the windows, crowd surfing every time.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, right, we're putting in the right gigs for the right people.
Yeah, and one of the things we're really key to saying, we've already touched on it with the chart stuff, but like, it's not just about the big crazy gigs. It's about how good the gigs are, and you can have the best gig of your life and there might only be 20 people there, but if there's 20 people like engaged and watching, and it's amazing. And like Beans on Toast, I don't know if you've spoken to him recently, but he'll be talking about how everyone sort of rates how good something was by how many people were in the tent at the festival.
Yeah,
and
that's not
how good it is.
Completely.
It's about the actual experience that you had at that moment. And so I want to keep that going on forever.
And I've remembered now the exact gig that we had done in Kingston, because it was one that was in a club night, another club night, and it was one that, but again, it was a really, it's still one of my favourite performances, because basically we had been booked to play this club night, and we were in the Alpine ski room.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And one of the other rooms was a karaoke room, and there was hot dogs for sale. It wasn't really, I think, and we were on about 1 to 2 o'clock at night.
This is Oceania. People who
which we got booked to do a load of them, so there was weird, like we did one in Portsmouth where the stage was above the bar,
right,
so literally it was the weirdest thing because you couldn't have the rowdy people at the front because that's where you're buying drinks, so there was a weird pockets of rowdiness throughout the venue. But the Kingston one, basically we started our set and there was a lot of people there just on drinks promotions, that's why they were there, weren't paying attention or were being a bit rude or dicky, but there was, I think we counted 6 people who'd come specifically for us. And the fact that those 6 people had to stay there until 1, 2 o'clock in that club that clearly wasn't their thing, just meant that we were like, right, we need to make this the best gig that we've ever done. And again, we spoke to those guys. I'm sure they all came to Banquet that time afterwards. And everyone, we talked about it being a really good gig and good moment because it was that that personal interaction.
Yeah, and that's important. That's what we all get. Like, it's not none of this is a music and arts in general aren't a science. Like, it's something.
Completely.
It's a real emotional involvement, and that's recognised.
Well, I mean, we've tipped over the hour marks, so we should start to wrap it up. But I want to talk to you about, I mean, this is coming out on Wednesday. It's Wednesday the 14th, the 15th?
Yep.
And, you know, so it's probably a bit late, but on the 16th, there's... Mm. So you're... you're taking, and again, it works perfectly because of everything we've discussed about your passion for the community and your dedication to. You're taking a step into politics.
That's
essentially
right. It's a weird one because I don't want to sort of really bring Banquet into it too much, but
course,
it is
yeah.
all about John Tolley. So if this one is about
yeah.
me, then
yeah,
that's
fine.
That's good. There's an agenda in Kingston to shut down this venue we're sat in right now
yeah.
and McCluskey's and a number of other of the places which play live music. And the council has been quite open in how it doesn't matter because you've got other pubs to go to. I
yeah.
mean, it's been quotes like that. Like a pub like O'Neill's kind of fulfills the same role
yeah.
as this
yeah.
place.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a world of
you
difference.
Know, Wombats won't play O'Neill's.
Yeah.
So in the last election, which was the same day as the general election, I ran as an independent candidate trying to stick up for youth culture and what I saw as like wrong decisions being made. And it was a battle, and it was a lot of the campaign was during record store day time, so I didn't
yeah.
really have a lot of time because that's our busiest time of the year.
Of course.
But did all right, and a lot of people kind of recognised that what I had to say was quite important. But, you know, it doesn't make really an impact on the party system that we have
yeah.
in the country and in the council. So throughout that campaign, there was the Liberal Democrats, which in Kingston are really the only opposition to the Conservative Party, got in touch and were like, we like what you do. I didn't know that this was an issue. And we sort of agreed to have some sort of like advisory role to the Lib Dems
right, yeah,
in,
sure.
in the future. And that was it, end of, and that was done. And then the night of the general election, which incidentally, every election we always have a drinks promo night. We're not very drinks promo, apart
yeah.
from on general elections. And then we give out a free drink, a red drink if it's a Labour seat, and a
right,
blue
yeah,
drink.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
great. I love doing those. That's my favourite thing about
yeah.
elections.
That's
and the first three were all cherry, and we thought we might have a good Labour government, but no. So we that night, the next morning, you woke up and we had, shockingly in Kingston, we had a Conservative MP, we had a Conservative national government, and our council is Conservative.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh God, like what now? You know, that's
yeah.
we've got these people who don't really care about what we do. I joined the Lib Dem Party that overnight,
yeah.
the next day, because
yeah.
I thought, like, I'm going to try and do something for my local area.
Yeah.
And then it was really bad, but one of the best local councillors in the area, she died quite suddenly. So there's a by-election for this part of Kingston, and
yeah.
because I just joined the Lib Dem Party, like for no reason other than just like take 50 quid and try and sort out Kingston,
yeah.
they asked us if I wanted to stand, and I thought about it for a bit, and I thought, yeah, it's the right thing to do. So I'm standing with the Liberal Democrats, but I'm just saying exactly what I said before.
Yeah, and again, I want to flag there because of certain prejudices. The mention of Lib Dem, a few people might have been, what a lot of people get so blind to in this country is the difference between a local politics and
mm-hmm.
and local councils and national
yeah.
politics. You need to fight the fight that's relevant in your town and in your local area. I remember going out years ago with a Billy Bragg and going door to door, and I'd agreed to go because it was in Barkin and Islington, and it was where the BNP had their strongest chance of getting a seat. I think they already had a few and were, you know, it was this big, they were getting this big push. And I got there to do it. And it was then that I found out from Billy that it was part of a Labour push. And at that point, I wasn't up for aligning myself to any
yeah.
government, particularly after how Labour had gone down some bad routes recently to that point. And Billy just kind of sat there and said, look, you don't have to align yourself to Labour. You know, he's obviously supported Labour. He's, you
yeah.
know, he's gone where he's gone for a long time. But it was like, the point is, we're locally, the best chance of getting the BNP out
yeah.
is voting for Labour. And in that area it was. It's like, there's other options, there's this and that. But, for example, at that point, and it's changing a lot now, at that point, a vote for the Green Party would effectively help the BNP,
yeah.
which they're so counter. So it was an interesting thing there. So, but again, we went in and we did that, and the BNP got no seats. Everyone went
yeah.
out and voted, and it worked. But yeah, I just wanted to highlight that. I think it can be easy to be confused between national and local. And the fact is, if everything that you've stood for locally, and you've stood for everything in this town for your whole life, if you then have a platform to get that across, right, then it's foolish to be, I don't like Nick Clegg.
So, yeah, you know, and like everyone will recognise all the problems of the coalition. Yeah. But I think what I'm doing is saying exactly the same things, but previously I was like shouting it as much as I could. Oh, look, the Tories are wrong on this. But now I'm speaking in quite an audible way, but there's a party behind it. So they're just amplifying the exact same voice.
Yeah.
And we're finding, because I'm recognised only within 2 miles of the shop, but because I'm a face of sorts, you find it's quite a lot of people that I would always vote Conservative nationally, but I like what you're doing for these gigs, or like, you know, and what have you. But I think the important thing, like you just said there, is that you've got someone who understands the town, who's trying to represent the town, because it's only an extension of what we do the rest of the year anyway. Yeah.
It grounds it so much that they can understand that they... Because it's so hard, again, I find it hard myself to not be cynical or suspicious of any kind of faceless politician, but then... when it's someone continuing to do what they've always tried to do locally and you've been aware of and supported, it's that much easier to go, all right, cool, that sounds like a win.
Yeah, so that's the vibe. I'd like to think that people from or around Kingston would be voting for John Tolley more than they'd be voting for the Lib Dems, and elsewhere the Lib Dem fans would be voting for their candidate. So
that's, yeah, completely.
That's fine, and it's no conflict for me, but I realised I do have to explain it to a few people.
And again, I feel it's fair now to reiterate what you said, that this is something that you're doing. It's not affiliated with Banquet. But again, I think the ethics that you've brought into how you run things there and how you work in the community, it's all relevant in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that. Again, it's really hard for me to be objective about it.
Yeah.
But Kingston is going to go through some quite big changes in the next 3 years, and so now's the time to act. And we need a sort of pragmatic solution to dealing with the problems right now, because we can't wait for 3 years to sort it out. But on that night...
Completely. If you can look and see a possible solution, it's better than sitting there and just looking at the problems, if you know what I mean, and going, oh, shit, it's not acceptable. It's like, right, so what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, and that's how I feel, and that's how I have to live as a businessman, you know, and what have you. But it's quite fun, because that night, there's an election going on in Kingston, but also that night, Fortet is playing here.
Amazing.
And so, you know, there's no kind of stopping what you're doing. And, like, I will be at the club night, and I'll run over the road to see what the results are. But as long as we keep doing what we're doing...
I love it.
Then that's important.
And well, that's perfect.
Let's say that other parties are available for vote. But I would like to think that even if people disagree, they won't like hate on me for it, because the intentions are obviously for Kingston, because people don't reckon, like, generally councillors don't pick up on what youth culture is about, and someone needs to.
And generally that's not, you know, or if they do, it's from sampling it for a day. I mean, I see this all the time. My mum and brother have all worked in libraries for years, and you see people making these huge decisions on one visit to a library and thinking they know how the intricacies of how all of this is run and what is needed and what isn't needed. And it's similar. So it's got to be a positive thing, regardless of how it ends, if you're bringing in people who have come from that community and society, rather than going, well, they look like they need this. So, do you know what I mean? It can only be a quick fix in that manner. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's been a fascinating way of learning about how this whole system works and about what people do and about how much... Like, and again, like, I kind of don't really want to say this too much, but like, there's parallels with DIY-ness in the political system. As much as there's some depths that people go to, there's some people who... don't live in Kingston, you're like, hey, I like what you're doing, I want to try and come and help you out. And it's for a shared goal. And even if you disagree with what their goal is, you can still appreciate that someone's given up their time to come and try and hand out leaflets or speak on your behalf in a different town. And it's like, until this process, I never really understand when bands are like, hey, we're really humbled to all the people who bought our album. I never really got it. I thought, you're quite proud, aren't you? You actually do see, like, oh my God, all these people are doing it, and it's because of you, and like, you owe them so much, and you have to be responsible. And it's and there's interesting things about like business and talking to people and finding out things about the community which I didn't know, even though I've lived here for like 12 years in the middle of town. So it's fascinating.
It really is fascinating.
And I'd just like people who, wherever you are, to like be bothered in politics, yeah. like, and to try and make your town better, whatever way you think that is,
yeah.
because you can. It doesn't take much to sort of get up off your bum and be like, I'm going to do this today, I'm going to make this better.
Have you considered doing a free fortet? A ticket with every vote, you know, just yeah, really, yeah, really bringing in. You get priority entry.
I think it would be incredible if we did win this seat, then all everyone who's helped out on this campaign will be coming over here, and it would be quite a culture shock for a few
amazing.
Of them. Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, that's perfect. Well, thank you very much for giving me your time
thank
and for
you.
Chatting and for the support over the years. In fact,
well, so we're big fans, so it's an obvious thing to do.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was John Tolley, JT, on the episode 48 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'd love it if you subscribed. That'd be swell. I mean, also on this particular episode, a word of mouth is great. As I've said before, when we've not got these big names, it takes that bit more to push people into it and persuade them to give it all a look. So, if you can give this a little push, then that would be lovely. Tell a friend about it. Spread the word. If you're in the music industry, whether that be working at a record label or a record store, working at CMU, you're working at, you know, anywhere, an artist, then this could be a relevant one to share around. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to be back next week. As I mentioned, we've got Neil Maskell, who I'm a massive fan of. He first came to my attention in Football Factory, but then he was also in Kill List and Utopia and Hyena and numerous other awesome things. And it was amazing chat. I also reveal the film that I've been working on. I've touched upon it and not really told anyone, but how me and Neil met was on set for a huge new film that's coming out next year. So yeah, tune in for that. Grizzly little bit of information if you fancy giving that a look. I can't believe I forgot that. I was listing all the things I was excited about for him. But yeah, that's worth a look. My advice would be to subscribe to the Distraction Pieces podcast on iTunes or Acast or wherever you wish. But yeah, and tell a friend, spread the word. Buy Kill the Wolf by B. Dolan, and generally have a lovely time and a lovely week. My name is Scroobius Pip. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. See you later.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.